Well, we've been Zooming with Redlands and with later with San Diego, and they all say give their hello to all of you. I think the first message that Alex gave and what I have to tell you will fit in well. In fact, when I wrote that in my notes, he continued, and it fits, I think, even better, as I hope you will agree. Heartfelt. Mine, unfortunately, is going to appear, though not meant to be, a little on the clinical side, because we're going to be going over Daniel chapter 11. And yes, Frank, we've had a good long friendship, but I don't remember it going back to 1888. But maybe you're right. I don't know. So let's begin, because it is a pleasure to be with you. I always welcome the opportunity to speak before God's people. And we're in the last few chapters of a very long road through Daniel. 10 down, 2 to go. I double counted, and it's 2 to go. Chapter 11 and 12. I checked my math, and this time it's accurate. But we now enter a continuation of the longest series of prophetic events in the entire Bible. The Babylonian kingdom, as a recap, has captured Jerusalem. Daniel has been taken captive back to Babylon. Jerusalem, in the process, has been leveled. Daniel has endured. He's flourished his captivity under these pagan systems. He has seen God's hand save him over and over and over again. And that's so very important to this book. But now he's possibly in his 80s, possibly in his early 90s. By the math, it really makes us think that he's of that age. There has been a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, and the captives are returning to Jerusalem, but Daniel will not return. He is not listed in any of the tribe lists or people lists. The reasons are not clear, whether it was age, health, or another. So we read Daniel for a number of reasons. Number one is his faith under absolutely catastrophically disastrous conditions. Although we say we are sometimes in a Babylonian environment or culture, it does not even compare in the slightest with what Daniel had to endure. He is the exemplar of how to survive in that type of a nation. The other reason, as today, is we will see God's hand in exacting fulfillment in prophecy after prophecy after prophecy, and the lessons we learned. In fact, our timing today, strangely enough, in the speaking schedule, coincides on our calendar with these events in Daniel 11. The title is Living in Babylon, Chapter 11, The Prophetic Wars. So today we're as close to ending this series as is possible. This chapter contains nearly 50 verses. And if I read it straight through, it'd take 8 to 10 minutes, but it would give you no background detail. So I'm not going to do either, because it is complex. The events fit with succeeding history into the last days. So much of this chapter, as we will discuss, has been declared false because it is so accurate. The dating timeline could not be real per the critics. And there are many. They hate this chapter. Of all the chapters in the book of Daniel and possibly the Bible, this is almost target number one for many of them. Yet it is true. I will refer you to the UCG Bible commentary, especially as it relates to the Expositor's Bible commentary, but any good conservative in the last 15, 20 years commentary will give you the massive amount of detail of this chapter. We had asked you last time we talked about Daniel 10 and part of 11 as homework that you remember that this chapter really relates to only two kings of the four of Alexander's empire after his death, and we're going to recount that. This is a recurring theme in Daniel. The Ptolemies are in Egypt. They are the king of the south. Think Egypt, south. The Seleucids, aka also known as the Antiochus reigns of the north. Think Greece and Syria predominantly. With Israel and Palestine stuck right in the middle, you might think of this somewhat, not exactly by any means, but very similar to the American Civil War. Kings of the North, kings of the South, and the battles that they have. And the freedom of the slaves are jammed in between. And that is so key. All told, once again, by Daniel living and enduring in Babylon. So let's begin, beginning in verse 1. And I want you to remember this is the angel speaking to Daniel. Daniel's listening, and he's also watching, in some ways, a vision. So Daniel 11, verse 1. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth, Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, that's Alexander, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. Also, verse 5, the king of the south, remember this is the Ptolemy, shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be great dominion, and at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south, Egypt, shall go to the king of the north, the Seleucids in the north, to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority. Authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Now, isn't that clear? All we know is that there's the kings of the north, and that's the line of the Seleucids, the Greece and Syria predominantly, the Antiochus reigns, and those are the Ptolemies of the south. And there's battle after battle after battle. What's interesting in verse 2, we're going to only focus on a couple of verses. In verse 2 of chapter 11, and I'll tell you the truth, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth will be far richer than them all. These kings were Darius under Cyrus, followed by these three kings, Cambyses, Gaumata, Darius the First, and Xerxes. You may remember the phrase Xerxes, the fourth king, who is felt by most commentators to be known by his Persian name as Ahasuerus. And he is the king in the book of Esther. So there's a relationship between Esther and Daniel. The mighty king is Alexander. It says he dies, and not his for his posterity that takes over, for his infant son is murdered. So he is without heir, and the kingdom is divided. It's divided among his four generals. And Daniel has repeated this in other prophecies prior. It's that important, the breakup of Alexander the Great's empire. Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, the south in Egypt, and the Seleucids, north in Syria. Again, only two are related. So when we see the words, the king of the south, it means the Ptolemies, nearby or close in Egypt, and the Seleucids of the north. King of the south, king of the north. We'll pick up the story in verse 14. And again, I want to recommend to you that get a good commentary, go to the UCG commentary section or the Expositor's Bible, and it will give the unbelievable and miraculous detail of whose daughter, it's specified, it's Berenice, and her, the power that she had. But let's pick it up because it is a little on the exciting side, but we will be here all day if we go through every verse. Now in those times, verse 14, bear with me now, verse 14, now in those times shall rise up against the king of the south also violent men of your people. Remember who he's talking to? He's talking to Daniel. So your people has to do with Israel or the Jews. Your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fail. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist, but he who comes against him shall do according to his will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. This is very, very important, these verses. It recounts the battles between Antiochus, Seleucids of the north, and Ptolemies, the king of the south of Egypt. It spans approximately 125 years. Verse 15 says, the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound. That literally happened with Antiochus III. Forerunner of the Antiochus IV that we know so well. Verse 16 talks about the glorious land. This is the Battle of Panium in 198 BC, where Antiochus III won over Judea from Egypt yet again. And Egypt and the Ptolemies and the Seleucids in the north fought over Judea over and over, back and forth, just like a tennis match. One side would win, then the other side would win. We then come to verse 20. We're going to skip down in verse 20. And this is a key section. It's a little long, so bear with me. There shall arise in his place, this king, one who imposes taxes. This is the northern kingdom. He will impose taxes on the glorious kingdom. There's that phrase again, glorious land, glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken. And also the prince of the covenant, this is speaking of the high priest of the temple, we think maybe it's Onias, and later and after the league is made with him shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his fathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, and the riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power, this new king, and his courage against the king of the south, in Egypt the Ptolemies, with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he, this king of the south, shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yet those who eat at the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. They actually, the king of the north and south, they believe, went to a peace talks and lied to each other at the table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, this is the king of the north, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. This is on his way back to Syria. In verse 20, Antiochus IV sends Heliodorus as the tax collector. Read verse 20. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. In fact, Heliodorus as the tax collector went throughout Judea to pay for the wars. They were under the auspices of the Syrian king, the Antiochus line, the Seleucids, and he said, somebody's got to pay for these wars. We're broke. So they went to Judea. In verse 21, this vile person, the word vile means contemptible. One of the Hebrew lexicons says, to raise the head loftily. And boy, does this fit this guy. This, in fact, is our old friend, this evil, vile person, Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, if we were reading this as a story, this is the time when you would say, boo and hiss. Because this guy is evil from the core. He is the one that lifts his head loftily. The word Antiochus is the family name. Epiphanius or Epiphanes means the glorified one, a godlike figure. In verse 25, Antiochus IV, this Epiphanes, boo, hiss, stirs up trouble with Ptolemy. Ptolemy is the son of Cleopatra of Egypt. That same guy. In verse 28, Antiochus in 168, you do it, boo, hiss. He goes on his trip back to Syria. He plunders Egypt. He just takes and pillages it while returning to the north. But here's the sentence that says, his heart is set against the Holy Covenant. That's code for he is going to target Jerusalem on his way back. In verse 29, and this is the verse, these are the verses that Daniel is known for, probably more than others. In verse 29, at the appointed time, he, the king of the north, and shall go toward the south, but it shall be not like the former or the latter. For the ships of Cyprus, or Kittim, shall come against him. This is the king of the north. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. Quick side point here. When it says the ships of Kittim, or the ships of Cyprus, this is code for Rome. Rome controlled the area, and Rome had gone to Antiochus and said, you've damaged enough. Go home. Go home now. And as he went home, he returns in rage against the Holy Covenant and to do damage. Verse goes on. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsook the Holy Covenant. This is in Judea, those who forsook the covenant, or those basically apostate Jews. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. For many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. But many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, to purify them, to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. There's a lot there, and I hope you picked up some key phrases. In verse 30, we talked about the ships of Kittim and Cyprus, referring to Rome. Rome is influenced very subtly at this point. They stop Antiochus, as we said, and on the way, he makes this siege against Jerusalem. In verse 31, so much is going on, and the forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary. They shall take away the daily sacrifices, place there an abomination of desolation. At least five things happen, a bit to recount of the previous. Number one, Antiochus Epiphanes the IV strikes a pact with apostate Jews, those that, in many ways, went after Greek gods and Greek ways. So he strikes a deal with the apostates. The temple wall is breached, then the temple. The daily sacrifices are stopped. Antiochus and his troops then sacrificed a pig on the altar. Defilement of defilement, of all things, to sacrifice on the altar. They then set up a statue either of Jupiter Olympus or Zeus Olympus to be worshipped. So either would, of these last two, the slaughtering of a pig on the altar or the setting up of a statue of Jupiter or Zeus, either one of these would qualify as an abomination of desolation. In verse 32, it talks about the people who know their God. There was a remnant in Jerusalem, in Judea, that stayed close to God. We know them as the Maccabees. In fact, we know in particular of Judas Maccabeus. He was of Hasmonean priestly dynasty. And Maccabeus, as you know, it is a fascinating story. Maccabeus is denoted as the hammer. So Judas, the hammer. They were true to God and his law. His forces, Maccabeus's did, the Maccabeans, fought doggedly against the Syrians and Antiochus, and they were slaughtered. The damage was heavy, but they persevered, and slowly the Syrian forces gradually were driven out. What's interesting, and we need not turn there unless you'd like to, Hebrews chapter 11 relates, interestingly, to these verses. If you remember Hebrews chapter 11, and you should from memory, it is the chapter of faith. It notes, they who shut the mouths of lions, that refers to Daniel 6, quenched the fury of flames, that refers to Daniel's three friends in Daniel 4 in the fiery furnace. And then Hebrews 11 says, those who became powerful in battle and routed former enemies, refers to the Daniel section here of Judas Maccabeus and his revolt. Much of these verses, 31 through 35, relate to these battles of the Maccabees against Antiochus Epiphanes. Though not in Daniel, there was a rededication of the temple. You may know what it is. It's a relighting of the lights inside the temple for a period of time. It's known by many names, the miracle of the oil, the festival of lights, and it's found in reference of the book of Maccabees, the first book. It is not in our Bible. It is in fact not in most Jewish Bibles. It's in Orthodox Bibles known as the Apocrypha. But Maccabees 1, and you can get it online very easily, talks about this very time in detail with this added dimension of the Festival of Lights. And I invite you to do that. What's more important, it was written at the time in the 180s, 120s BC. So as timing would have it, as I said earlier in the introduction, as timing would have it with the speaking schedule, funny enough, we're in the midst of that very famous festival. You know it as Hanukkah, and that is the lighting of the lights. So when you see someone lighting the lights of their Hanukkah menorah, not a regular menorah, a Hanukkah menorah, it has 9 sticks, one for each of the 8 days plus one lighting stick. So As an aside, further aside, if you want a little bit more homework, if I haven't given you enough, you can look up John chapter 10, verse 22. And you can see who writes about the Feast of Dedication, because that's exactly what Hanukkah means. It's the Feast of Dedication. So now we come to a very interesting juncture, very interesting in the book of Daniel chapter 11. And I hope I haven't bored you with too much detail, because there's 5 to 10 times more if we'd have read all these verses. But it's important for the setup, the prologue, as it were. Remember, Daniel is writing prophecy, these verses. And we can see from history, by looking back over this time period, that it fits detail for detail, point for point in the historical record. But this interesting next section in verses 36 through 39 are interesting because there's much debate over them. The debate is these attributes in the description of a king can't really relate to Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, this vile person. It must be speaking of someone else. Therefore, they are more likely speaking of a later or latter fulfillment after the time period of Judas Maccabeus and the war with Antiochus. So let's read verses 36 through 39. And then the king, this is the king of the north, shall do according to his own will. Now, as we read through this, I want you to remember what we know about Antiochus Epiphanes and what he and his armies did in Jerusalem. So remember this. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a God of fortresses, and a God which his fathers did not know. And he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. This can't be describing Antiochus, because he did just exactly that. He did set up gods and altars that were very well known to the gods of his fathers, very much so. Verse 39, thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and to divide the land for gain. So we see these things cannot relate to Antiochus Epiphanes. They must indeed relate to a future prophetic king, possibly a king at the end time, with periodic forerunners. These forerunners could very easily meet many, some of these, all of these attributes, but there will be one final king. We then come to verse 40 through 45, the end of the chapter. Let's read it. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north, that's the antecedent for him, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hands, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and from the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. There's a lot there. So this talks about, as we've understood it for years, to be the very final culmination of the end time, the time of the very end. Verse 45 says the glorious holy mountain. Most commentators think that this is possibly Mount Moriah, the temple. This is always seems to be the center. And you can see the verses that we've read through chapter 11 the kings of the north and the kings of the south, they sandwich in the center, Judea, Jerusalem, the temple, always seem to be the pivot point. As he's coming and going, they cross through Israel and destroy it over and over again. Finally, they fight back. But you can see that Jerusalem is the center of it all. What is interesting is the countries that are mentioned. Edom, Moab, and Ammon no longer exist. Those are no longer countries, nor does Babylon or Assyria. Egypt and Libya do exist. They're nations today. And their descendants still exist. Moab, Ammon, and Edom are replaced principally by Jordan, the country of Jordan. Babylon is now principally Iraq. Assyria is now principally northern Iraq and southern Turkey. It is a very tight space geographically, and I think it's important. We can think of other nations that may be involved, especially as we see the world geopolitical signs. We can see the maneuverings by different countries even now, but it's still mentioned here in chapter 11, verses 40 through 45, a very tight geographical place. What will happen in the end? These nations could very easily play a part. And whereas we never, or at least I don't want to ever, definitively place without any doubt these ancient lands and their prophetic fulfillment, I think there is danger there. We now understand in our world of the last 15 to 20 years, at least in our understanding, in our lifetimes, the concept of proxy wars. Proxy wars were a larger, much more powerful, much more militarily equipped country lends aid to support a lesser in their battle. We saw that many, many times between the United States and Russia, whether we sent troops and Russia sent troops, and those are considered proxy wars. China has an interesting, relatively new concept. It's called, and I got this pronunciation, Yidai Yilu, which means one belt, one road. You may have heard of it. This is where they give infrastructure to a lesser developing country or a moderately developing country. They literally go in and set up rails, roads, and internet infrastructure. It is now in 70 countries around the world. The Chinese premier said in 2013, quote, "One Belt, One Road is a bid to enhance regional connectivity and embrace a brighter future." Yeah, right. They're doing it out of their nobleness. Russia lends arms and troop support to many different countries all over the world, both covertly and overtly. And so does the United States. So indeed, we could have, with little doubt, very easily proxy wars at the end time. And as much as the geopolitical changes that we see now do change, there is no way to know what could happen in 5, 10, 50 years. This chapter, chapter 11, is the longest continual prophecy of the entire Bible. And 80 to 90%, it's rough math, 80 to 90% of it is fulfilled in minute detail. And again, I want to encourage you to go to a good commentary and read about this. It is unbelievably fascinating how detailed Daniel 11 is fulfilled. It is so accurate that, as we said, the critics feel it was written by anybody but Daniel. In fact, they believe that if Daniel wasn't the writer, of all the people on the earth, it wasn't Daniel. It was written during the times of the Maccabean period or long afterwards, because it is so detailed. It's so exact in fulfillment. It's called, there's a Latin term for it, so those of you that took history will have heard it, vaticinium ex eventu, which means a prophecy delivered after the event. In other words, it is pointless. Let me give you an example. As in the first message, talked about this plague we're under. If someone knocked on your door today and said, you open the door and they said, there's going to be a worldwide plague. The name of it's going to be COVID-19. You've been warned. They did it today. Don't you think they'd be a little late? It's already happened. We would hardly call that a prophecy. But yet that is exactly what they ascribe the book of Daniel to, especially 11. It's after the fact. But there's a logical problem here. Gleason Archer, in his commentary, says this, and I'm going to read this slowly because it's very well said. Other commentators say something similar, but I thought this was best said. Quote, if the author of Daniel did not wait till the fulfillment of Daniel 11, verses 40 through 45, if they did not wait till the fulfillment of 11, 40 through 45, before composing these verses as predictions, there is no valid reason for insisting that this author devised the other predictions fulfilled in the 4th, 3rd, and 2nd centuries only after they had actually been fulfilled. He's saying if this author of Daniel, that these critics say wrote Daniel, wasn't Daniel, was the author of Daniel during the time of the Maccabees, if he didn't wait for the fulfillment of verses 40 through 45, but waited for the others to be fulfilled, that doesn't make any sense. They would have waited till it was all fulfilled, the whole chapter, and then written it so that it would accord with prophecy, all prophecies. So the details of chapter 11, verses 1 through 39 are detailed. Excuse me, through 36 are detailed. Through the rest of the chapter, they're not fulfilled in any detail. Why would he do that? That evades credulity. So there is still left in this the 20% left to fulfill. When will there be partial forerunners? We don't know. But there will be a final, ultimate conclusion. Final, ultimate conclusion. The big question is always, has always been, and will always be, even now, is when will be the end? I have an answer for you. I think this is pretty accurate. We don't know. We don't know. And maybe we're not supposed to. To many, the year 2020 would be the 45th anniversary of the ushering in of the kingdom of God. I'll let you do the math on the beginning date. It didn't happen. It wasn't even close. I'll let that sink in. To others, based on these verses, it was 1986. One California prophet who said it was first 1986, then said it was September 1st, 1994. No, check that. He then changed it to September 29th. Nope, that wasn't going to work. So on September 30th, he changed it to October 2nd. Wait, he then said it's May, then September of 2011. Do I need to explain to you that didn't happen at all? They were all wrong. All false. Every one of those dates was false. That prophet, better hope that Deuteronomy 13 and 18 are not in effect as it relates to prophecies. But I want to read you something that is right after this section. I want you to remember that there are no chapter breaks, no verse breaks in Daniel in the original. Turn with me to the next verse. Chapter 12, beginning verse 1. We'll cover all of chapter 12, Lord willing, next time I speak. But chapter 12 and verse 1. At that time, remember verse 40 said, at the time of the end. So chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael will stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people, remember this is Daniel being spoken to, this is Israel, God's people. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. These are powerful, powerful words. And they're a part of this prophecy. It's therefore incumbent upon us while we live in a type of Babylonian system and culture to know and to understand. This was brought up in the first message, that the book of life, is so very important. Those who believe God and have accepted his son, Jesus Christ, are people of this book, written in this book. Those written in this book, as Psalm 139 also said, will escape. Chapter 11 shows us that God the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ, are in utter, complete, almost mind-bogglingly detailed control. Detailed. When we were in San Diego, we had an interesting discussion about how much does God know in the universe. I'll tell you what many of us believe. It is indescribable. It is impossible for a finite human being to understand how two infinite beings control the world. They are not physical. They are above and beyond physical. They have no beginning. They have no end. And yet man thinks he knows the answers. There is no possible way for us to understand the control that God has over this world, the events in this world, and the people in it, especially the people in us. Jesus tells us he knows who are his. We know and understand who he is. So this is our hope. The book of names, the book of the Lamb, as it's talked about in the book of Revelation, Daniel says through all the prophecies, through all the wars, all the prophetic wars, all that have happened since time began till now and on into the future, God is in utter and complete control. This is our hope, to be in the book of life where our names are inscribed. Our goal is to faithfully live our lives confident of God's mercy. In fact, that part was in the opening prayer, that indeed we incorporate these concepts into our very lives, that we have confidence that indeed God loves us. He has not only chosen us, that we are also part of. So as we faithfully live our lives confident, we're also to reflect as evidence of our good works, of this hope, evidence of this salvation, to live the words about the book in your lap, the book in front of you, the book on the app on your phone, the book on the app on your tablet, wherever it is, in whatever form, these words are the words that we live by, the book that we have in front of us. That amongst the wars, the rumors of wars, that we should have peace and understanding that of all that happens, we know our future, and our future is secured.